Hey, it's Francis Lamb, and thanks for downloading this Splendid Table podcast. We hope you count on us for cooking, culture, and conversation all year round. And we count on support from listeners like you. So please, help chip in to help us make the show you'll love. Give today at splendidtable.org/donate. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for curious cooks and eaters. I'm Francis Lamb. So I was born and raised in New Jersey, the northern part of New Jersey, no less, but I'm proud to have been called an honorary Southerner. I say proud because the more time I spend there, the more friends I have from there, and the more I know the South as a complex, difficult, and beautiful place, full of stories. We think it's traditional, but it's always changing. We think it's all about barbecue, but it's also rice and peas and corn. And we think it's all about black and white, but it's also yellow and brown. This week, we're all about unexpected stories about the South. Secret curry kitchens in South Carolina, a chef in Seattle fighting fried chicken stereotypes, oh, and hippies. John T. Edge is one of the sharpest thinkers on Southern food we have. And that's one of the best laughs you'll ever hear, because when you really get him going, which isn't hard, it's his full porcine snort. And that laugh is an important part of what he does. As the director of the Southern Foodways Alliance, he sets up Southern food as this big, inclusive tent, one that welcomes and honors and ties together people of all races, politics, and walks of life, which is not easy. But a big, endearing laugh has got to help. So when I found out he was writing a food history of the modern South, I knew it would be smart, sensitive, and challenging. What I didn't realize, though, is that his book, The Potlicker Papers, would be so full of surprises. It's got stories of a furious Colonel Sanders driving around in a Rolls Royce with his own face on it, cursing at what his food had become. It's got stories of the gospel star Mahalia Jackson lending her face to a fried chicken chain to help build wealth for black franchisees. So we asked John T. to come in to talk about some of those surprises. John T., great to have you here.
Thank you, Francis.
So let's talk about your book, The Potlicker Papers. So the book is a history of the South told through food, and starting with incredibly powerful stories during the Civil Rights Movement. I mean, stories that literally made me cry. But what I want to talk to you about are people we don't necessarily associate very often with the South. And when we think of hippies in the 60s and 70s, we think of California, we think of Woodstock. But you write in the book that there were these huge and hugely important hippie farming communities in Tennessee and other points in the South. Tell us about them.
Well, if you think about that moment during the Civil Rights Movement, when it was made clear by way of protests, demonstrations and the like, that the South might be a place to quit. The South might be a place to leave. The Great Migration had been drawing people north for generations. In that very same moment, the Back to the Land movement catches traction. And one of the places that the long-haired hippie freaks, and I say that playfully because that's the way they were spoken of with disdain, one of the places that the men and women of San Francisco traveled to was the American South. So Stephen Gaskin of San Francisco, who was a Marine Corps veteran, taught these Monday night classes in the Haight-Ashbury, and he helped his followers kind of channel Eastern religion and Western religion. Gaskin began to draw a crowd for Monday night. By the height of it, he was drawing 1,000 people who listened to him and ultimately followed him to Tennessee. Mm-hmm. Gaskin has a vision, though. He says that the cities are part of the problem. And as the drugs intensify and crime intensifies, Gaskin says we must quit the hate and we must go east. And in 1971, he's speaking before his amassed faithful about the promise of the world beyond the cities. He said, the worst thing happening on the planet is the cities. Like, the cities are the major cause of warfare, poverty, totalitarian police state, whatnot. All those things are functions of being crowded up in cities. And he says, After the services, the caravan is to take off to Tennessee and get a farm, because what you put your attention into, you get more of. And I need more trees, more grass, more wheat, more soybeans, more healthy babies, more good-looking, sane people, people that can work.
But why, like, what did the South mean to them? Because, I mean, if they just wanted to go trees, I mean, there are plenty of trees in California and somewhere between California and Tennessee.
True. There was a kind of mythology of the South for that generation. The American South was a place they believed untrammeled. The American South was a place wherein their kind of naive fantasies about going back to the land could be best accessed. The American South was kind of the root of all things American, a kind of primeval land where they believed that they could reattach the tethers between their lives and the lives of their forebears.
It's so interesting because there's this, you know, Southern food in so many ways, I think, has become sort of our national regional food, where so many things that we think of as being classically American have roots in the South. And it's so interesting to think that that idea is bigger than just the food. I mean, there's this myth almost of the South as being sort of a purer America. And so they get there and they have these farming communities. How did they interact with their neighbors, and how did they influence their neighbors and their neighbors influence them?
Stephen Gaskin and his followers at the farm came South because they appreciated the agrarian lifestyle that was possible in Tennessee. And they saw value in the men and women they met. There was an intergenerational connection there. These were young people in their 20s and 30s, and they befriended people of an older generation, people in their 60s and 70s. This was a moment in the American South also when the Foxfire books came to the fore. A teacher in North Georgia assigned his students to go visit with their elders and learn how they skinned a hog or how they made lye soap. And that intergenerational connection that the Foxfire books engendered was the same sort of exchange that Stephen Gaskin and his followers aimed for. They wanted to learn the old ways. They wanted to learn how to farm with a mule and a plow. And they saw the same appeal in those kind of connections that they did when they like dropped the needle on a Joan Baez album and recognized that when she sang Butcher Boy, it was borrowed from Appalachian hollers and Appalachian songs.
Right. And about the stuff that they were growing and eating, you wrote that these were largely vegetarian communities. And certainly much of Southern food is naturally vegetarian, but this is also a place that, you know, worships the pig. So did their diet, was it weird? Did they influence people around them? What were they eating, and how did they... Because you also write that these communities actually have far-reaching influence that we still feel today.
Yeah. I mean, the first crop they adopted was a crop already resident in the American South, in that part of Tennessee, sorghum. Mm. So they raised sorghum and harvested the crop communally. There's a beautiful picture in my book of these long-haired kids standing around pulling in the sorghum harvest. And they marketed that sorghum. They came up with labels, sold them in stores around town. Beatnik sorghum was the label under which they sold it. And that became, you know, they knew how they were perceived in the community, and they played off of it. They were honest about the exchange, which was, to me, kind of beautiful. They recognized that, you know, the communities around them found them odd. You know, this was a moment when, after the Tate and LaBianca murders, and this is a moment when people saw long-haired hippies and thought, oh my gosh, this is some kind of cult that's come to visit us. And Gaskin and his followers were as open as they possibly could be and were wide-eyed and almost beatific in their approach to these elders and said, teach us. We want to learn.
Hmm. And at the same time, they also turned around and I think you invented like nutritional yeast and started making commercial tofu.
Yeah.
Tell us about those kinds of innovations they made.
Well, Gaskin had a vision that soybeans were kind of the future tense food. And along with growing sorghum, they began to grow soybeans. Gaskin and his followers were really innovative. They conceived one of the first commercial soy ice creams, which they called Ice Bean. And they also began working on tempeh using sweet potato slips. These innovations were the way they paid the bills. These were commercial enterprises. The farm was self-sustaining for the longest time, and the farm and the people who lived there thought that the way they would sustain their community was by way of agrarian beliefs and agrarian knowledge.
Oh, that's interesting. I love that they had to invent, they had to innovate. So they integrated themselves in terms of the people, but they couldn't integrate their economy necessarily. So they had to create things like soy ice cream.
And they tried hard to integrate within the community. There's a great scene in the book wherein people from the farm and a Pentecostal church nearby gather to have a joint service. And those moments, which were quite intentional on the part of the farm, they had deep respect for their neighbors and wanted to communicate that by talking about religion in an open format. One of my favorite parts about that in researching that moment in the farm's history, I found an article in the Tennessean, and when you look at the byline, it's Al Gore Jr.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, he was a Cub reporter.
Oh, man, so that's the beginning of Al Gore's career, too. So much started, so much began over there in the woods of Tennessee. Thank you so much for coming in today, John T.
My pleasure, Francis. Thank you.
John T. Edge is the author of The Potlicker Papers, A Food History of the Modern South. I love talking with him, as you can probably tell, and you can find more of our conversation in our podcast feed. We talked about a rageful Colonel Sanders and Mahalia Jackson's role in the fried chicken business, and that's coming soon to your podcast queue. And coming up, an unexpected Indian hotel empire in the South. I'm Francis Lamb, and you're listening to The Splendid Table from APM American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM American Public Media, the show for curious cooks and eaters. I'm Francis Lamb. Let me try to describe for you the single greatest grocery store I've ever been in. It was the size of a small amusement park, and in one corner, there was a team of Mexican women making fresh tortillas. There was a produce section that had fresh green peanuts and fruits and vegetables I'd only ever seen in China, and lots of stuff I'd never seen before, period. There were more spices than like a Silk Road bazaar, and there were more brands of Korean pepper paste than I thought there were Korean people. It was incredible. And this store wasn't in New York, where I live, I wish, or in LA. It was in Memphis, across the street from a church with a 70-foot replica of the Statue of Liberty holding a gold cross instead of a torch. So forget the coasts. It's the South that has some of the fastest-growing immigrant communities in the country. And some of these communities are a little less visible than others. If you've ever stayed in a motel in Georgia or in the Carolinas, chances are it was owned by an Indian immigrant from Gujarat. And if you didn't know it, it was by design. They often change their names from Rajiv to Rick, put Christmas trees in the lobby, and hire non-Indian desk staff. The Charleston Post and Courier's food editor and chief critic Hannah Raskin brings us this story she reported for Gravy, a podcast produced by the Southern Foodways Alliance.
If you want a room at the Days Inn in North Charleston, you have to bring your ID and credit card to the front desk. But one of the two tinted glass doors leading into the lobby is broken.
Give me your name, please.
That's Jaquel Gethers, who works at the desk. Every shift, she watches people impatiently tug on the wrong door. They're in a hurry. They want to get their key cards reset or drop off a package or see about catching a cab downtown. What they don't want to do is linger in the lobby, because mid-range hotel lobbies are boring. The Days Inn lobby is tidy and clean, but the only diversions are a TV tuned to a random movie channel, a brochure rack with coupons for the nearby outlet mall, and a water cooler.
Days Inn Airport, how may I help you?
For hotel guests, the lobby is the business end of a vacation or a love affair. For many hotel owners, though, the lobby is where their homes begin. And that's not just true of independent places with names like Southern Lodge or Seaside Inn. That's how it works at franchise hotels, too. Guests may not realize that the door behind or near a check-in desk doesn't lead to a closet or an office. It leads to an apartment.
My name is Vimal Patel, and I am at Days Inn on West Montague in North Charleston, South Carolina. I've been here in North Charleston with this Days Inn for 15 years now.
And he lives on the premises.
We have an apartment. We have broke in between rooms, six rooms, three bedrooms, one living room, one dining, one kitchen.
Vimal was born in Nairobi, but grew up in India, where his father was a dairy farmer. For a few years, he tried farming too. Then in 2001, he immigrated to the U.S.
So I had that wish that one day I would like to have my own hotel. After 9/11, it was a recession, and this place was for sale for quite a while, and we ended up getting it.
On its face, hotel ownership is kind of a surprising ambition. How does a man living in a country that has fewer hotels in Florida go from milking water buffalo to renting out rooms in Charleston? As it turns out, Vimal comes from a part of Gujarat state that has a long history of citizens leaving to work in travel industries abroad. In the early 1900s, so many Gujaratis worked as ticket agents and station masters in East Africa that the whole train system was nicknamed the Patel Railway. Now, there's a phenomenon known as Patel Motels. They're called that because so many Indian immigrant motel owners share the same last name. All these Patels are not related. The best estimate is that more than half of all the motels and hotels in America are owned by immigrants from a tiny part of Gujarat state. And in southeastern cities, such as Charleston, the figure is upward of 60%. One of the many other Mr. Patels running a hotel in the Charleston area is Jay Patel. He's owned the Star of America since 1988.
Nobody talks about it. No. Nobody talks about it. They say, oh, I stayed at a hotel yesterday. His name was Patel, too. I'm staying tomorrow at a hotel. His name, Patel. But they never get into the middle of how this happened. I think if they did understand it, I think they would start appreciating more, too, of what some of these ethnic groups are making impact to the American economic and the society.
Most of the rooms at the Star of America are rented by down-on-their-luck folks who make the motel their long-term home. Increasingly, Patels are running boutique hotels, trading up their motels near highway exits for in-town properties with pools and on-site restaurants. But there are still many Patel-owned motels that contract with city governments to take in veterans and other people who would be homeless without their help. That makes Patel motels an important part of the social safety net. But if you Google the term, you probably won't come up with a bunch of social media posts praising the Patels for their hospitality. You'll find complaints about curry.
For the entire 3 days, the room reeked of curry. The smell was so strong that even spraying deodorizer and opening the windows didn't help.
Listen to these Yelp reviews from Joy R., Bobby W., Andy O., and Cherry J.
Typical Patel motel. Walked into the lobby overwhelmed by strong smell of curry. As a black person, when I walked into the lobby, they stared at me as if I was interrupting their curry potluck.
Strong curry smell around the building and hallway, even my room. I called front desk to complain. I don't understand what the lady said, but something like, why you complain? Why people always complain? Things like that. Then I just hanged up. WTF!
And why are most motels owned by Indians?
Many Gujarati hotel owners make a point of cooking exactly the way they did in Gujarat. Because they are near their kitchens all day, they can make the pepper sauces and halva and dosas that many Gujaratis who work as doctors or engineers, whether here or in India, just buy on the way home. So they end up preserving important and old-fashioned aspects of a cuisine that's respected throughout Asia.
All over India, when you say Gujarati food, then it's the best food.
Jay Patel says there's a reason for this.
State of Gujarat is very strict vegetarian. And they grow their own produce. You know, it's a big farming state. So every house in the village, they'll grow their own peppers and ginger and garlic and dry and powder and everything right there. So, you know, you're getting the top quality. It's organic.
Jay Patel's pride in his Gujarati heritage is shared by his fellow motel owners. Even though it's hard for owners to get away from their motels, they'll see each other at religious and cultural events, organized partly so the immigrants' children will be as proud of their home stay as they are. Let's go back to Vimal's kitchen, which he refers to as a hangout. To be clear, Vimal isn't a traditionalist. He eats meat. He's tried making quesadillas. Sometimes the guy who's willing to let a reporter into his kitchen isn't the guy who's doing things the way they've always been done.
Yes, I have got a big green egg, actually.
For the uninitiated, a big green egg is a Komodo-style clay grill manufactured by a company in Atlanta.
When I came to Charleston, I started with a small $19 metal grill. Slowly, when I got my hands on my, you know, cooking, then I got big green egg, and I just love that big green egg.
Vimal uses the big green egg for kebabs, seasoned with spices he buys from Charlotte.
This is my refrigerator, microwave, grill, and stack of a chair for people who come, and a big shelf to store all my tools for the cooking.
Atop the counter, there's a long line of beverage options.
Yeah, there is always a stock of good scotch, Black Label. Especially Black Label is always there because my dad loves it, so it's always there.
He serves the kebabs on styrofoam plates with yogurt sauce, tinted with turmeric and sugar, soft biryani rice, and chopped up red onions.
My kitchen is right at the end of the hotel, so where there is a minimum traffic of guests and any visitors, so, you know, it doesn't bother mostly anybody, but if somebody passes by sometimes, 97% of guests would say, well, can I try some?
Vimal's cooking is so good that the owner of Taste of India, Deepak Rathore, hears about it. Taste of India is a northern Indian restaurant in Charleston where motel owners sometimes get together. Vimal always wants Deepak to come for dinner, but even when he can't make it, there's usually a small crowd.
Normally, whenever I cook, I always have 2, 3, 4 friends. And sometimes, you know, those friends know that he will be cooking. So even I have forgotten to invite them. They'll just pop in, which is, you know, most welcome for them. There are a couple of retired police officers from North Charleston. And there's a lady. She worked at the Home Depot. And a couple of my other Indian friends. So we have a mixed crowd of, you know, different color. It's not only one brown. We have brown, black, white, yellow, everybody.
At first, Vimal set up his kitchen because he didn't want food aromas to seep into the public areas of his hotel.
Shortly, probably end of this year, I'll be moving out to a house.
Now, the house he's buying has a kitchen, so he doesn't have to worry. He can cook at home, miles from where his guests stay. But he's decided against shutting down his space at the hotel.
Probably I will miss it, but I'm still going to continue that my kitchen. So when I have, you know, company instead of at the house, I'll entertain them here. So I will still be on the property.
So if you're ever staying at the Days Inn and pick up the faint aroma of curry wafting from the back of the building, you may want to drop by the very last room in the hotel. There's no number on the door, but Vimal will probably be there.
Hannah Raskin is the food editor and restaurant critic at the Post and Courier in Charleston, South Carolina. This story comes from the Southern Foodways Alliance podcast, Gravy. Thank you to Thomas Walsh for cutting it down to size for us. And the full episode is called Dinner at the Patel Motel and was produced by the SFA with the Post and Courier. And you can find it in all its glory at splendidtable.org. Every week, we check in with our friends at America's Test Kitchen to see what they're geeking out over. And this week, they got the memo that we're doing a Southern show, so they want to talk about their killer recipe for South Carolina smoked ham, which I'm totally psyched to eat, but, I mean, it's a Southern show, and look, not a lot of South Carolinians are trying to get their smoked meat advice from people in Boston. But Tucker Shaw, executive editor for Cook's Country, fears neither man nor beast nor barbecue chauvinist. And he talked with our managing producer, Sally Swift.
Hey, Tucker. Great to have you.
Thanks for having me, Sally.
So I know that you guys have been roaming around the Carolinas for Cook's Country, and this week's show, we're kind of focusing on the South, and I wanted to talk to you about something you discovered at Heights Barbecue.
What a great place Heights Barbecue is in West Columbia, South Carolina. And you're right. We've been spending a lot of time in the Carolinas, and we expected to find a great pulled pork dishes down there. But what we didn't expect to find was this wonderful dish at Heights Barbecue. They smoke fresh ham, and it was delicious. We spent more time there than we expected to because we couldn't stop eating it.
Huh. Now, fresh ham, which is a different thing than most people think about. Usually you smoke shoulders, right?
That's right. Shoulder is a much more common piece of meat to use on the barbecue. When you think about pulled pork or something like that, it's usually cut from the shoulder. Ham, as you know, is cut from the hind quarters, mm-hmm. as we say delicately. Mm-hmm. And whereas most of the hams that you'll find have already been smoked or cured mm-hmm. or otherwise treated, fresh ham is really raw meat. So what you're looking at is essentially ham that has been taken from the hindquarters of the pig and not messed with at all until you start in on it.
Okay, so talk me through this recipe. So you call this essentially smoked fresh ham, correct?
That's right. And what makes it different from the shoulder is that fresh ham has much less fat and connective tissue kind of all the way through it. So after it is smoked for several hours, what you get is a meat that is a bit leaner and a bit chewier. Hmm. And it's very easy to achieve at home. It takes a little bit of time, but it's not complicated to do. The most difficult thing for creating this recipe is special ordering this piece of meat because you won't necessarily find it at the grocery store ready to go.
Okay.
So when you hit up the butcher, you're going to ask for a fresh ham cut from the shank end, which is farther down the leg. And the reason that you want this piece is because it has more skin, and you're going to make use of that skin later in your final dish.
So what's the first step in this recipe?
The first step in this recipe is to get some seasoning into the meat. And the best way to do that is to salt it, rub salt all over the meat quite liberally, a couple of tablespoons for a 6 to 8 pound piece of ham, and let it sit for 18 to 24 hours. And this will draw that seasoning into the meat and make it much more flavorful.
Okay, so that's the day before. That's a commitment.
That's a commitment. Mostly hands off.
Right.
Then the next day, you go outside and you build yourself a fire, and you want to add some wood chips to that fire. It's very easy to make a packet of wood chips folded into aluminum foil. And you drop that ham onto a hot fire and let it go for about 2 hours. Mm-hmm. And this is not enough to cook it all the way through, but it is enough for it to take on a great deal of flavor from those wood chips, which is what you're looking for. And then you bring it inside to the oven to finish cooking. And the reason you do this is because the oven has a much more sort of predictable and constant temperature, and you don't have to continually tend your fire outdoors. And after 2 hours on that fire outdoors, it's taken on about as much smoky flavor as it's going to anyway. So you finish it in the oven for about 2.5 hours, and you bring the ham out of the oven, and with a pair of tongs, you grasp at the skin and just slip it right off that piece of meat. It will come off in one large piece.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't take any special technique or anything. It will just slip right off. You take that skin and you spread it flat on a sheet pan. Slide it back in the oven for about 25 minutes. This will create a really crisp, slightly golden brown, beautiful piece of pork skin that you'll often find sort of chopped up and called cracklin.
Yeah.
And what you're going to do is take the meat that you've smoked and the skin that you've cooked and chop them together.
Aha. Uh-huh.
So you have this chewy, crunchy, fatty, delicious, chopped up thing that at first glance will look very familiar because it will look a bit like pulled pork. But once you sink your teeth into it, you're getting this whole texture contrast and really, really great flavor of ham and pork.
What a great way to do it. So you get the smoke from the grill, and then you can abandon the babysitting and just bring it in the oven and finish it off. This sounds like perfect party food. I mean, it's graduation party time, you know?
Totally. It's summer. I mean, get out on the grill. And the reason we knew this recipe was a hit was because the test cooks in the kitchen went crazy for it. And as you can imagine, you know, they cook a lot.
They're jaded.
Yes, a little. Not jaded. Everybody loves food, but we are definitely skeptical. But this one, we couldn't keep it around. People just went bananas for it. So we knew we had a really strong winner with
this. You had a winner. Now I do have a question, which is very controversial. So let's talk sauce, which I know every Southern barbecue is different. Sauce in that area is mustard sauce, correct?
Very often, yes. And this is a tether back to some of the German heritage that you'll find in this part of the country. At Heights Barbecue, they serve this with sort of a rather runny, but very vibrant vinegary mustard sauce. So we created a sauce that's very similar to that. It looks like a little bit more runny than you would think of as a thick barbecue sauce. And of course, it's a very bright yellow color. So it almost looks like, you know, just a squeeze of yellow mustard. Mm-hmm. But it's got this really, really invigorating flavor that pairs beautifully with a slightly sweet and fatty meat.
Okay, starving here. Thanks, Tucker.
Thank you, Sally.
Tucker Shaw is the executive editor of Cook's Country at ATK. Find that recipe for South Carolina fresh smoked ham at splendidtable.org. And while you're there, be sure to take a look at this week's video. It's about the culinary journey of Michael Twitty, the writer behind the blog Afro Culinaria, who relives the cooking lives of his enslaved ancestors. Coming up, I get to talk with you. So give us a call, 1-800-537-5252, or find us on Twitter or Facebook, or you can email us at contact@splendidtable.org. I'm Francis Lamb, and you're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Francis Lamb. All right, now we get to talk with each other. Give us a call, 1-800-537-5252. And we have Nicole calling from Portland, Oregon. How's Portland? I miss Portland.
It's delightful this time of year.
Oh my God, it's the greatest. But you actually called with something you want to talk about, and what is that?
I have a question about Brazil nuts. My question is, I love having a small decorative bowl of nuts around the house, just, you know, downstairs. It's a good, healthy snack. And what I found, though, is that especially my husband, who really likes to eat them, whenever I fill up a bowl of nuts, every other nut gets eaten. And then I find myself with an empty bowl of nuts except for the Brazil nuts. And I got really tired of throwing them away. So I start keeping track, and there's just a ton of them, and I don't know what to do with them, but I can't throw them away. So please help me.
Oh no, the poor unloved Brazil nut.
I know.
You know, you're not the first person who's told me this. I don't know how this has come up in conversation in the past, but people have been like, I hate Brazil nuts. I'm like, what's wrong with Brazil nuts? Why do people not like Brazil nuts?
I don't know. I think it's their overwhelming size.
Well, I have to confess, you know, because people have said this to me, I'm like, hey, what's wrong? And the next time I saw a bowl of mixed nuts, I like picked out the Brazil nuts and ate them. And I was, they're kind of also not super delicious. I mean, there's nothing wrong with them whatsoever, but it doesn't have like the richest flavor. And so I kind of get it, but I think you're onto something with the size. And I would say if the size is a problem, you can take care of that very handily, you know, just chop them up. And once you have them chopped up, then I think, okay, well, what will you do with a bunch of chopped nuts? And like, oh, you can do anything with chopped nuts. And I would say you can certainly candy them.
Oh,
and I think they get really nice and crisp and a nice caramel coating. Have you candied nuts before?
I have not, no.
There are like 45 different methods. But the very simple way that I like to do is I just make a caramel, you know, sugar in a pan with a little bit of water to get it wet. And then once it starts to caramelize, do it in a nice big pan, like a saute pan. And when it gets to a nice deep color, just throw in the nuts and stir them around so they're nice and coated in the caramel. Pour it out onto a sheet tray or on, ideally if you have like a silicone mat, pour it out onto that, spread it out while it's still hot. And then, you know, when it cools off, you can break it up into chunks. And so you have these like nice candied nuts, sort of like a brittle. I think technically a brittle, you have to add other things.
But yeah, that sounds delicious.
Yeah, so that's a nice way to treat them. Or I really love to toast nuts in butter. But a trick that I was taught once by a chef was you'd use a lot of butter. You put a bunch of butter in a pan, maybe a saucepan. You add the nuts and you cook them. And as the butter starts to foam, the butter will start to color, you know, the butter will brown, and you'll see the nuts start to take on color. And then after all the foam is gone, and you're basically at the stage where you're frying the nuts, and they get to a nice golden brown, maybe even like a medium brown, then you scoop them out. You know, you can drain them on paper towels, salt them, and there's something about cooking in that butter. I don't know if the butter actually gets into nuts or if it's just the coating around it or if you're browning the butter and so some of that nice brown milk solids gets onto the nuts, but it really, really makes them extra savory and extra sweet and extra rich. So it's a really delicious thing to do with them. And from there, like, you know, sprinkle them on things, sprinkle them on pasta. You know, I love sprinkling chopped toasted nuts on pasta. It's not something that people talk about. People talk about doing the breadcrumbs, but I love that.
It's almost like pine nuts, quite crunchy. Put in pasta.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. It's not super crunchy, but it gives a little bit of texture and a little bit of fat and richness with each bite. So, yeah, I would say you can do those with your Brazil nut collection, and probably they won't be hated anymore.
That's a great idea. Actually, as soon as you said just chop them up, I don't know why I didn't think of this, but I would even maybe put them in my favorite like chocolate chip cookie and nut recipe even.
Totally. Or just chop them up and throw them back in the mixed nut bowl and like challenge your husband to take them out.
See how many people eat them. I am a
You're not getting out of it this time.
This could be potential for some kind of a research project. Right. Love it.
Great. Well, thanks for the call.
Great. Thank you so much. Actually, I will try both of those, so I appreciate it.
Terrific. All right. Talk to you later.
Bye.
So we have Faith calling from Santa Ana, California. How are you, Faith?
Yeah, I'm good. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. What would you like to discuss?
So I love to entertain, but I recently became a vegetarian, and I do want to make sure that I have some like lovely meat options for my fellow meat-eating friends. But I'm so used to tasting things on the way, and I was wondering if you had any kind of foolproof meat dishes that I could either like do the sauce separately and taste that on the way and then combine it. We're wondering for some ideas.
Oh, well, that's a really interesting question. It's funny because my mom is actually a vegetarian also and continued to cook meat for the family for, you know, this has been over 30 years now. And I mean, I love my mom to death, but she was not always the best cook. But she was incredible. Like one sort of supernatural skill she had was she could make tasty meat dishes without ever tasting them.
So yeah, that's what
I'll give you my mom's number and then we could be done. So actually, I guess I would say a couple things. One is long-term. I think I actually asked her like, how do you do it? And she goes, I don't know, but she cooked enough over time and learned to season the meat by sight where she just started to match up like, okay, if it looks like this, when I put on this much salt, you know, if I just kind of know what it looks like, or if I'm marinating something in soy sauce, I kind of know it's going to be this wet versus like soaking wet or whatever.
Gotcha.
And she just learned to figure it out by doing that and then asking us to taste it. Does this taste right? Does this taste right? So long term, I guess that could be your play. But I think that, so it sounds like the toughest thing to do is seasoning, right? Like you've cooked meat before, you already know how to cook and you know how it looks and how it should feel when it's, you know, cooked to the temperature you like it, or obviously you can use a thermometer.
Yeah.
So if seasoning is the issue, I kind of want to be like, let someone else take that burden off your shoulders, right?
Okay.
And I'm never unhappy to walk into anyone's party or at anyone's table and just see a mound of sausages. You know, like a really beautiful roasted sausage or a grilled sausage, you know, or pan-seared, something like that. And that can go well with many things you're making anyway. If you just find an appropriate sausage to like whatever style of cuisine you're cooking, you know what I mean?
Okay, yeah. I mean, I used to cook sausage a lot too.
Yeah, perfect. So like that's a great thing to have in your back pocket. And just in general, I think keeping it simple, keeping it dry heat, meaning, you know, if it's something like a braise or a stew where you're counting on the flavor to develop over time and you're tasting and adjusting, that might be trickier for you right now until you get the hang of it. But something grilled, seared, you know, like a roast pork loin or something like that, then really it's just a matter of just salting it enough to sort of cover it slightly. And then if people say like, oh, it's a little bit under seasoned, you kind of know it just a little bit more. And that's not a hard learning curve, right? And then you can get something like that going in the oven pretty well. But again, just to take it off your hands and get some sausage going and you're good.
Yeah. No, that's a great suggestion. Thank you so much.
All right. Glad I could help. And if you need, let us know and I'll put you in touch with my mom.
All right. Sounds good.
All right. Take care. We always want to hear from you. Give us a call, 1-800-537-5252. You know, it's a truism to say that the food you grew up eating is the food that will always bring you back home. But for chefs who saw the kitchen as a kind of escape or a way to get to a different world, the food you grew up with might not be what you want to be cooking. Eduardo Jordan is a son of Florida and Georgia and one of the most respected chefs in Seattle, famous for the salumi he learned to make in Italy and the fine dining techniques he honed at the French Laundry and Per Se. Along the way, he noticed that he was almost always the only Black Southerner cooking in these kitchens, so he never thought the scene he was excelling in would get it if he opened a restaurant cooking the food he grew up with. Then he decided to find out. He opened June Baby, named after his father, and we want to talk with him about what he's learned and why he took the plunge. Chef, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Francis, for having me.
Well, first of all, congratulations on opening your restaurant, June Baby.
Thank you.
I actually want to start by talking about the restaurant's website, actually something I saw on the website, because right there, next to your hours and your menu, there's a statement, and there's some talk there about stereotypes, and there's
right.
a mention of Aunt Jemima as a stereotypical Black character, and there's another mention of people of Appalachia often being stereotypes, so obviously, this is an issue that's on your mind, the stereotyping of Southern food. So what are some of the stereotypes of Southern food that you see?
You know, I think a lot of people quickly define Southern food with several ingredients, normally fried chicken, watermelon, and collard greens. And everything else in between is, oh, it's heavy. If I eat too much, I'm going to gain weight. And that is not true. That's not what Southern food was built on. And me being in the Northwest, really far away from the South, I figured and I knew that I needed to educate people about Southern food and what I'm actually trying to do with the restaurant.
Yeah. What are some of the things that surprise some of your guests who might not be steeped in Southern cuisine?
Just the diversity of the ingredients. I always go back to like the staples and the backbone of Southern cuisine, which was built on a lot of West African ingredients and techniques. And, you know, we're talking about bringing in the rice, peas, root vegetables, collard greens, and various leafy greens. And I'm just educating people on those ingredients.
Obviously, you're talking about history. You're not just talking about rice and peas, but you're talking about, I want to feature rice and peas because this is the food of that fed the enslaved, and that's the backbone Correct. Of our country and our history. So you did a lot of research. You grew up in Florida. Your family's
Correct.
From Georgia. But you did a lot of research to open the restaurant. You traveled. What were things that surprised you most in your research about the cuisine that you didn't know about?
The diversity of Southern food throughout America, it's, you know, I think the easiest way to look at it is, you know, we always comparing European cuisine to our cuisine and how like Italian cuisine, you go to Sicily and you get this beautiful ingredient, you go to Parma and you get this beautiful ingredient, and how each of those regions of some European country is so steeped and so beautiful. That same outlook can be looked at in the South. Because you go to Kentucky, you're going to get something slightly different than what you'll get in Tennessee. You're going to get something slightly different in North Carolina than what you'll get in South Carolina. The way something is cooked in Georgia or what is grown in Georgia is going to be slightly different than what's grown in Florida. And so, like, that was one of the most beautiful things that for me to experience, again, it's just all the diversity, all the different characters, all the different growing regions throughout the South and what they're actually focusing on, from the smoked hams to bacon to various produce. And then you can get into the barbecue belts, and that's a whole nother story on its own.
Yeah. Let me ask you one more question about your menu. It's actually not about the menu. It's about you as a person. But I think Uh-oh. Your menu reflects that. I was surprised to see a few things on your menu. You have chitlins, you have neck bones, you have a slice of watermelon. Now, these are Southern items for sure, but
I think there are also items that a lot of people associate, especially with Black Southern food.
Right.
And I was surprised to see it because I was reading interviews with you in the past, and you said before that you're a fine dining chef, and you're concerned about opening a Southern restaurant because you don't want to be pigeonholed as, frankly, as just a Black dude frying chicken.
Right.
So what changed to make you feel like you want to go all in on cooking this food and representing it this way?
Yeah. It started, I guess, from my foundation cooking with my mother and my grandmother. All that I knew was Southern cooking, big family type of meals. Everyone at the table enjoying candy yams and rice and peas and smothered pork chops and liver and onions. And, you know, that's all I knew. That was my foundation. That was my heart and soul. That's what made me think about the restaurant industry. And then once I went to culinary school, it was French based. And it was a whole new world for me, like learning about all of these amazing restaurants around the country that are cooking cuisine that I had no clue about. It was just an eye-opening experience for me. So I at that moment thought that was the route that I needed to go. And, you know, I think that is the direction that most culinary students go, because that's what we're forced into from a culinary school standpoint. We're traditionally trained in French cuisine, and that's the route that I went. I worked with the best chefs in French restaurants, also in Italian restaurants, gained a beautiful appreciation for the cuisine and the ingredients. And as I was finding myself and finding my voice, I realized that I just kept being drawn to the Southern aspect of my menu. And I don't know, I realized that I needed to become a voice in my community here in Seattle, because there wasn't anyone actually doing Southern food. And I started questioning myself, why was I running away from Southern food? And it was because, like, that was all that I knew. And I also didn't want to become like, oh, the chef that opened a restaurant in Seattle, he opened up a Black restaurant because he's a Black chef and that's what he's supposed to do. Mm-hmm. I wanted to bring another aspect to who I am and showcase myself as a chef, because I trained to become a great chef. And that's what I wanted to be recognized as, a great chef, not a great Southern chef, not a great Black chef, but a great chef. And, you know, I didn't think hard about it, you know, but it did come into play later on down the line of, like, I shouldn't open up a Southern restaurant first. And I later on down the line thought about it, and I'm glad I didn't, because I think it kind of opened up the door for me to be able to have a bigger voice in the culinary industry right now.
Mm. Avoiding that pigeonhole from the beginning so you can come back into it harder later.
Mm-hmm.
That's great. Well, thank you so much for joining us today, Chef.
Thank you.
Eduardo Jordan is chef owner of June Baby and Solare, both in Seattle. And that's our show for the week. I hope you had fun with us. And be sure to be here next week when Lynn is back, looking at the spice-laden food from Central Asia and the Caucasus. In the meantime, let me leave you with this thought from Booker Wright. He was a Black Mississippi waiter who was interviewed on TV in 1965. He said, "The meaner the man be, the more you smile." Our show is produced by APM, American Public Media. And hey, I want to get one more plug in for our website, splendidtable.org. You'll find tons of recipes, you can register for our monthly giveaway, take a look at our video collection, and sign up for our newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen. If you want to take the show with you wherever you go, subscribe to our podcast, and if you like it, please leave us a review. Special thanks this week to our friends at the Southern Foodways Alliance for sharing part of their gravy episode, Dinner at the Patel Motel. The story was originally produced by Tina Antolini in collaboration with Charleston's Post and Courier. Gravy is the podcast of the Southern Foodways Alliance, a member-supported nonprofit at the University of Mississippi. Learn more about the SFA's work, sharing stories of the changing American South through the foods people eat, on their website, southernfoodways.org. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Courtney McEwen. Jennifer J. Lou Lubke is our editor and technical director. Chip Walton is our digital associate producer, and Sally Swift is our managing producer. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.